Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Have you ever woken up to water underneath your floorboards? Because that's what happened to me today.
Yeah.
And it's Saturday, so nobody's coming.
And yeah, Jillian also rents her house. So there's another whole bag of tricks to deal with that one, too.
And my landlord is in China.
Yeah.
And it's 10 o'clock in China, at least in one of the time zones. So
10 p.m. or 10 a.m.? Probably 10 p.m., right?
P.m.
Yeah. It's 10 a.m. here. Duh.
So, and he's usually pretty good about responding, but, like, he's literally, like, our times are completely off. So, it's, like, the thing is, it seems like it's a slow leak. So, what we're going to do, I think, is turn off the water. And we've been filling up stuff, so that's why I've taken so long to hop on, is because we've been filling up water. And
well, what's funny is, like, people don't know that it took you forever to hop on because they just turned on the episode, and this is
that's true.
This is when you come on. So
I literally was like, okay, getting on now, and then Haley was like, okay, I'm waiting, and then it was like, oh wait, never mind, I have an emergency, like, literally a minute later.
Yeah, and also, like, this is an hour, well, it's funny, right now we're recording at, like, our usual time that we record,
yeah.
But, like, the time that she had sent on our calendar was an hour earlier to when we record, and so I texted her, because she lives an hour behind me, and so I texted her, and I said, hey, did you mean to do this at, like, 9 a.m. my time? Because, like, you know, just making sure.
Yeah.
Typically, it's 9 a.m. her time, and so she was like, yeah. And then I get another text and she's like, wait, no, maybe not, I don't know, LOL. I was like, okay. And then she's like, I'm dealing with an emergency here. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, just let me know. Hope everything's okay.
And now we're, like, waiting for landlord to call back. I think he just texted me back. I guess he's in the States now. So lucky us.
Well, good.
But yeah, so Corey's taking care of it. But woke up this morning, did my normal thing. We were doing whatever, because you couldn't really tell because it's such a slow leak. But when you squish down on the floorboards, like, water comes up around the edges.
Yeah.
And they're like those linoleum fake wood. So at least there's that.
Yeah.
But we may need our floors replaced, our subfloors replaced now.
Well, that's going to be a cost on your landlord. That's not your cost.
No, it's not. But we're going to have to deal with it, you know.
Yeah.
People coming in working on the house.
Man, if I lived closer to you, I'd just be like, hey, come stay with us.
Yeah. Well, we might see if we can stay with our friends for a little bit. But
yeah, even when you said this stuff about, like, a fan, I was like, oh. In my head, I was like, oh, you can just borrow ours. But I was like, how am I going to get my fan to Jillian?
Just come on down. It's only, like, 16 hours.
God, like, even when you guys dealt with the freeze, I was like, I wanted to send you guys, like, a care package, but then I was like, how would it even get to her? Because, yeah, like, cause everything was frozen.
It was awful. So bad.
Yeah.
So,
and then if it's, like, hurricane
so,
season, like, we're probably both going to be dealing with the same storm just based off of the way that it tracks.
Yeah, I could. It depends, but I
You
feel
know?
like it's either East Gulf or West Gulf storm,
That's true.
typically. You know what I
But
mean?
it's funny because, like, when it's hurricane season and I see something start to develop, I text Jillian and I'm like, hey, look at
Yeah.
this. I'll let you know how it is because it's
Because
going to get here first.
we're completely at like the northwestern part of the Gulf, and you're completely like at the southeastern part of the Gulf.
Yeah.
So I could stand in the Gulf and like wave in your direction,
Yeah. Funny.
But yeah, so woke up, did our things, and then I brushed Marzi's bed, which is on the floor, with my ankle, and it was like soaking wet. And so I was like, oh my God, has she been like peeing herself in the middle of the night? Because it was a ton of water. And
Yeah.
you can't really tell on the floor until you really look at it and start squishing down. And
Yeah.
we were like, oh my God. And at first we were like, are we gonna have to take Marzi to the vet? Nope, just floors covered in water. But honestly, this is
Well,
like
thank
us
God
sleep.
it's not Marzi.
No, I know. I know. I know. I feel bad because she's sleeping on a wet bed all night, though. Corey was
Yeah.
like, yeah, she was shivering this morning. And I was like, oh,
I
baby,
wonder why. Oh.
no.
Yeah.
So that's how I'm doing. And since you got to take Waylon to a vet appointment yourself.
Yeah, but he's just getting a nail trim. And then I asked if he could get his butt squeezed because he's been licking his butthole a lot. And like today's my Saturday, but it's Alex's Tuesday.
Oh.
And like I was sleeping so good. I was in the middle of a dream. I was going to the Grand Canyon with some friends. Like, you know, it was good dreams. And then like this morning I hear like I get woken up by Alex going like, God, Waylon, stop. And I'm like, what is happening right now? And it's just because he's like licking himself and Alex hates the sound of him licking himself.
Licking.
And I'm like, dude, like most mornings Waylon is the one that wakes us up. But today it was you. I was having a good dream. Like, like really, it's my Saturday and I've been like working my ass off. I'm exhausted. Come on, dude. Just like put some earphones in or something. Just ignore it. Like, what's he doing to you? Nothing. He's just looking himself.
Corey's the same way. Like, Marzi wakes him up so easily. Meanwhile, I'm like passed out. So it's been funny because he's been waking up early to do gill nets, and I don't always go on gill net. So, like, Marzi's like around 7 o'clock. She's like, Mom, like jumping on like the bottom of the bed, like, because she knows she's not allowed on the bed unless we let her. And so she just like jumps up and then jumps back down.
Yeah.
Jumps up with
She's
her
like,
front paws and then gets back down.
I just want to make sure you're still there. Okay, you're still there? Okay. No, your story really reminds me of the time that our in the house I rented like a few years ago, the first house that I even lived in down here, the only house besides this house I've lived in. That when did you remember when that like my bathroom shower had a leak? Did I ever tell you that whole story? It's really
Vaguely.
reminding me of this because I that house, you know, it's on stilts because keys, that's kind of like how the houses are built just for the flooding and everything. But there was a downstairs enclosure that was ground level and that we just used it as our storage room. Like we hardly went in there because it was just like where we kept seasonal stuff and just extra boxes. Yeah, I took a shower one day and like there was like water coming from like the, you know, the plate where you turn the knob that's on the wall that's underneath the shower head. So there was like water spitting out from that and I was like that's weird, but like hopefully it's not a big deal. I just thought it was like kind of like a le like a little like a little bit of a leak that wouldn't be like detrimental. I was like maybe that's just a weird thing that's happening. And it was small enough that I thought that maybe it was like just the wall was wet from the shower head too. You know what I mean? So it was a little sketchy. And so anyway, long story short, took a shower and then I went down to the downstairs enclosure to get something out of there. And Waylon followed me in and I heard him like stepping in water. And like, you know, that kind of like splashy sound. And I turn around and the fucking ceiling has like rotted and there's like a puddle of water. And I was like, oh my God, what the hell? And so like I immediately texted my landlord. I was like, hey, my shower has a leak in it. And like I think it's been there for quite some time. But like we would have never known because how often do you take a shower and then go to your downstairs enclosure and see that? And so she was like, okay, I'm gonna send my husband out to take a look at it. Cause her husband, like, is Mr. Fix It. He, I don't know what his like credentials are, but she pretty much sends him first to do like whatever patch job. Yeah. And then she'd hire somebody else if she couldn't figure it out or he couldn't figure it out. And so I told my roommate at the time, I was like, hey, you know, this is a situation. They're going to come over and look at it. You know how type A they are. So I would highly suggest cleaning your bathroom because, you know, we had separate bathrooms and it's like, I'd suggest cleaning your bathroom because chances are they're going to look at both bathrooms and make sure, you know, everything's good in both of them. Because for this scenario, like he did not clean his bathroom. And so they come over to check on the leak. And like the morning of that check, I pass his bathroom. I see that his boxers are on the floor. His like sink is like dirty and unorganized. And like the toilet's got stains in it. Like it's just like dirty, boy dirty. And I was like, you know what? I warned him. Not my problem.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
You go ahead and deal with that one. And so my landlord calls me and she's like, Haley, you need to go like look in the hall bathroom. And I was like, why? First of all, this landlord trusted me as like the primary contact of the house, no matter how many roommates came in and out. And so I was like, why do I need to go look in the hall bathroom? That's not my bathroom. That's not where the problem is. Right. And she was like, just go look in it for me. And I was like, what? I was like, Arena, what am I looking at here? Like, why are you like running me around in circles? Like, just tell me straight up what's wrong. And she's like, do you not see a problem? I was like, dude, I know he's dirty. His boxers are on the floor. Like, what am I looking at here? Like, and she goes like, she's like, look in the shower, like look in the tub. Jillian, this tub floor, black. It was black.
Oh,
and
no.
I was like, oh my God, that's disgusting. She's like, who lives like that? He's got, she went as far to call him a drug addict because she's like, only drug addicts live like that. And
yeah, like, no, grown ass men do because yeah, their mamas did not teach them right.
Because she was bitching about to me about all of that. And I was like, hey, I hear you. You know, I get that it's dirty. I warned him to clean it. Like, I tried to tell him it needs to be cleaned. And that's as most as I can do. Like, that is not my space. I am not responsible for his mess. And I am not going to clean up after his mess. Right. And so then later that night, like, he, like, is bitching to me about her. And I'm like, dude, like,
yeah,
come on. Like, you know, it's her
Your
house.
Shower is
like,
black. Maybe
yeah,
do something
like,
about it.
It's
like,
disgusting.
That's not an unreasonable thing to be upset about.
Yeah, like, he's like, I can't believe she got mad at me for not cleaning her bathtub. Like, you know, it's like, dude.
Yeah, it's her house. Like, that's how renting works. You have to not trash the place. How do you get a bathtub black?
I don't understand. And so, you know, when he was ranting about it,
gross.
He tells me that she has given him 24 hours to clean it or we're evicted. And I was like, dude, I am not getting evicted because of your fucking mess. So you got to clean that shit up. Like,
holy shit.
He was all sorts of annoyed with that scenario, but this is what you're going through kind of reminds me of that, where you're like, oh my God, there's this leak that just happened. And how the fuck did this happen for so long? And that we didn't know about it. And now like,
sneaky.
You know, it's
sneaky,
a sneaky
leaky
problem. Yeah. Sneaky leaky.
Well, I think it's a Swinford tradition at this point because my mom had to replace all of our flooring after the washing. I think the washing machine had a leak. And then again, we had a leak. Oh, and it got down into the basement. And then I think the other one was maybe AC, but I can't exactly remember. But
oh my
like
God.
We have had, it's a leaks in the last like decade or so have been like a thing. So it's, you know, just the Swinford curse at this point. So yeah, so fun. Now that you know what I get to deal with today, why don't we speed along with our story so that you can be on time for your appointment. All right.
But yeah, let's get to the story because I know beginning stuff is a lot for you to cut out.
Yeah, and this is like, I went on a deep dive for this one because
I see you have like what, seven sources?
Six
here.
Pages.
Six pages. One,
and this
two,
is just
three,
part
four,
one.
Five, six sources. Oh, right. This is a two-parter.
This is a two-parter.
Hey, when I was looking at conservation animals for this one, I have a list pulled up.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were penguins. And I was like, did I fucking do a penguin already? And I remembered that I did. I was like, okay. Mental note, no penguins. No penguins.
Yeah, so if you haven't figured out from that, this one takes place in Chilean's favorite place in the world, which she's never been to, which is Antarctica. So, and we get to talk about Shackleton a little bit during this one, but it's mostly going to be focused on the race to the South Pole
Yeah.
because we kind of talked about the space race last time, last
It's all
episode.
these races that are happening.
I know, and I don't know if I did this intentionally, but the next episode topic I had was like the South Pole race, which I bought the book for this like I don't know, a year ago, and I'm just now getting to this topic because the book was like so thick. The book that I bought was so thick that I just kept looking at it and like I need to read this, but it's so intimidatingly like thick.
Yeah,
Which,
that's how
if
I feel
somebody
about normal
isolated
books.
that, that like bit, oh my God, what you could do with that. But it was a big book, okay? It's a big book. And most of the stuff, or I'd say probably about half of the stuff we're talking about will come from that book. And it is called The Worst Journey in the World. It is by Apsley Cherry Garrard, who was one of the expedition members for this particular story. So he's got like first person stuff on everybody, and then also has diaries from like all of the expedition members that he
That's
has in the
cool.
book as well.
Nice.
So it's very thorough. And this
Yeah.
is like very trimmed down version of everything that happened. Like that book goes into details. And I didn't even read the whole thing for a variety of reasons. But so let's kind of get into what exactly we're talking about today.
Yeah.
And that's about competition. So it's in human nature to want to compete with one another, claim we are better, stronger, and faster, claim we are more intelligent, and claim we cannot be bested. Friendly competition, or even more slightly more serious rivalries, it's not necessarily a life or death situation. In most cases, when we lose, we come out physically unscathed, or for the most part. But when you add another variable into the mix, another player, it complicates things. When you are not only competing against your fellow man, but competing against your environment, things get dicey. It's hard to predict what you may find in your environment or what weather conditions will come to limit your speed or your strength, or even take away your life. In this episode, we talk about the beginnings of one of these competitions, competition much like the space race that we talked about in episode 57. The South Pole was viewed as the final frontier during the great age of polar exploration. It was somewhat seen as the last corner of the great terrestrial map that needed to be filled in. And so the nations of the Western world, just like with the moon, saw it as a prize. And that is why in 1911, two explorers unexpectedly squared off to claim the pole for their own country. But the South Pole, like many rugged corners of our planet, could not truly be claimed. And the Great White Continent would keep one of the explorers in return for eternity. Ba, ba,
Bum,
ba,
bum,
ba. Okay. So, early 1900s, polar explorers were basically like astronauts were in the 1960s.
bum.
Like, that's the kind of fame and like notoriety they had. And so they were viewed as like these big public figures in many ways.
Yeah.
But they're just regular dudes. I mean,
They're just being
intelligent
dudes.
dudes, but like regular people, you know?
Yeah.
And so let's talk about kind of our two main players in this race. One being Robert Falcon Scott, which he wins the award for like coolest middle name, I think.
Falcon.
Falcon.
Yeah.
It almost seems like one of those like nicknames. They're like in quotations, you know? Like when they
Yeah.
write, like, you know, like, I don't
It's
know,
like
like.
their what's the thing called when like the military or Air Force gives you like your code name or nickname, you like go by that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
What
kind
that's
of
called.
the vibe, but it's his actual middle name. So, freaking Falcon over here.
It's like, that's cool as a middle name, but if that was like his first name, people these days would like roll their eyes and be like, oh my God, another stupid Falcon name. Like,
like, what's up, Falcon?
Yeah. But I was like, if it's a middle name, it's okay though. Like,
yeah. So he's born in 1868 in Devon, England, and he's from a seafaring family to his father, John Edward Scott, and mother, Hannah Scott. Poor health kept his father from the family's tradition of serving in the military, but he inherited a small brewery from his father, so Robert's grandfather. Cool. Robert grew up on a small country estate, and his mother came from a respected and well-to-do family from Plymouth, also with a history of military service. So he was like middle class, I would say, like squarely in the middle class. Yeah, it sounds like
he's comfortable.
Yeah. Robert's parents called him Con, C-O-N, mm-hmm. which I'm like, what a waste. You should have called him Falcon.
Yeah.
Like, we'll shorten it even more.
What's that meme out there where it's like, imagine if, it's like, what if we, instead of calling like Timothy Tim as a nickname, we just called him Moth. or Mothy or something. It was like something like that. There's like Moth. Some meme out there like that. I think I saw it on like Wild Green Memes for Ecological Fiends or something. It's instead of Tim as a nickname, we just call him Mothy. Like,
that's like instead of calling me Jill, I'd be Ian.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. That's all what they did here. Instead of Falcon, just Con.
Con.
That makes me think his name could be Connor. Like,
yeah, or Conrad. Connie.
Yeah, anything. Yeah. Connie.
Okay, so back to Falcon. Should just call him Falcon for the rest of the...
I'd be okay with that. Falcon instead of Con.
Yeah. He had two older sisters and a younger brother and sister, and was always very close with all of his family members, especially his mom. Mm-hmm. As a boy, he was described as shy and weakly for his age, as well as dreamy. And had always had dreamy. An uneasiness with the sight of blood and suffering, like with animals, something that he actually carried to his Antarctic days. So he was a sensitive boy, which we love.
But you said something about blood?
He didn't like the sight of blood.
Oh, I thought you said with a side of blood. And I was like, what? Like, At first I was like, oh, he sounds cute and nice. And then you're like, with a side of blood. And I was like, oh, is he insane? Like,
no, a psychopath? Uneasiness with the sight of blood and suffering of animals, was not a fan of that. So, sensitive boy, dreamy sensitive with boy. A side of blood.
That's why I was like, huh? Interesting way to describe somebody, but okay.
But despite this, he joined the Royal Navy in 1880 when he was only 13. And actually quickly took to the military life, with his naval experience turning the boy to a man. And he became a promising young Navy man, shedding off most of his prescribed weaknesses. While a midshipman, he met geographer Clements Markham, who was thoroughly impressed with a young Scot. He first became a first lieutenant in 1897 when he was serving on the HMS Majestic, when he met Markham again, who was now president of the Royal Geographical Society and had planned to fund an expedition of scientific discovery to Antarctica. He wanted Scott as the expedition leader. Scott was only 32 at the time. Mm. During the discovery expedition to Antarctica in 1901 to 1904, he learned the ropes on the continent and proved to be a reliable and competent scientist and leader, and was promoted to captain when he returned to England. It was the first Antarctic expedition that the UK had done in 60 years. So it's kind of a big deal. Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Ernest Shackleton actually served as the third officer on this expedition. And it was his first Antarctic expedition as well. But he was forced to leave in 1903 due to a physical breakdown caused by scurvy on a sledging expedition to reach the pole. And the furthest south that this expedition got towards the pole was the 82 degrees south latitude line. So as a reminder, the South Pole is 90 degrees south.
they're like 8 degrees away from it.
Exactly. Yeah. In between the Discovery Expedition and the Polar Expedition, he married a sculptor named Kathleen Bruce in 1908, and they had one son named Peter, who became a famous naturalist later on in life. So,
Oh, cool.
talented science and art family, which we love.
Yeah.
We're here for that.
We love that for them.
We love that for them. So his competitor is Roald Engelbrecht Grevening Amundsen, or Roald, as the
Didn't say that.
Norwegian.
That's a mouthful.
Yes, it is. I'm going to call him Roald because I speak English and that's how we pronounce that name.
That
But
really
it
gives
is
me
pronounced
like the,
Roald in Norwegian.
yeah, that really gives me like the Schitt's Creek vibe of Roland, where she calls him Rolly. She's like, "Oh,
Rolly. So we got Falcon
Rolly."
and Rolly.
Yeah.
So he was born in 1872 in Borge or Borgi, a town near Oslo, Norway. Amundsen had a somewhat similar background to Scott, as he belonged to a family of Norwegian ship owners and captains. His parents were Jens Amundsen and Hannah Salt. I don't know how to pronounce this one. Salkvist?
I'm gonna look at it for you.
Salkvist.
I'm looking at the pictures just to see if I can
And
follow.
he was the fourth son in the family. Hannah wanted her son to avoid a life at sea when Roald was encouraged to become a doctor. And this was a promise he kept until his mother's death when he was only 21. And then when she died, he promptly dropped out and shipped out to sea.
Oh, he was like, all right.
Yeah. So
You're
it's like kind
gone.
of
I don't have to
sweet.
impress you anymore.
Yeah, but then at the
Oh.
same time, you're like, all right, bud,
Yeah.
go do what you want to do. As a young man, he was enthralled by Sir John Franklin's narratives of the Arctic, which kind of shaped the course of his life. So if you remember, John Franklin and all of his men were lost to history trying to find the Northwest Passage. We talked about that one, like, I think our first year, where they like, all the men disappeared. We've never found their bodies. We
Yeah, they've
just
just
now,
vanished.
yeah, we've just now
Was
found the
that
ships.
ones with like the leather shoes, or was that Shackleton?
That, yes, leather shoe eating.
Was
Yeah.
that one or Shackleton's?
Not Shackleton's. They
Okay.
never ate leather shoes, I don't think.
But it was that one with the men just like vanishing and they don't know what happened to them.
Yes.
Okay.
And cannibalism might have been involved, and it's a good
Yeah,
one.
that's a good one.
So Amundsen's first Antarctic experience was in 1899 aboard the Beluga expedition, which he experienced hardship through his first Antarctic winter. But this didn't stop him from a polar exploration, as he became the first to actually travel the Northwest Passage completely in his ship, the Gjóa, in 1903 to 1906, following in Sir John Franklin's footsteps. So it was after this that he turned his attention to reaching the North Pole. So this guy actually did what John Franklin set out to do.
Cool,
Yeah.
nice. And
So
how
he's
many
like,
years after did that happen, did you
oh
say?
gosh. So I think it was like in the 1840s that John
Okay.
Franklin was there. So it's like a good like 60, 70 years after.
Gotcha. So
Yeah.
definitely sometime.
Yes. So after the 1901 Discovery Expedition that Scott went on, Britain soon turned their attention back to Antarctic exploration and the South Pole. So before Scott's expedition to the pole, Shackleton actually made a polar attempt in 1908 during his Nimrod expedition.
Okay, so can we just talk about the name of that expedition
I,
though?
yeah.
Because it's like you're a Nimrod and you're naming
Yeah.
it Nimrod, and like that just
Yeah.
gives it's like setting the wrong tone. You know
It
what I
is.
mean? It's like
And
jinxing the expedition.
I'm wondering like when that word changed from like a good thing to a bad thing, because it's the name of the ship.
Yeah,
All the
maybe it was after
expeditions
that.
are named for the ships that they like went down on.
Yeah.
So like the Discovery was the name of the ship that they went down on, but Nimrod, yeah. So I'm like,
Yeah, I
when did that
wonder.
become like synonymous with moron? I don't know.
Maybe it was after that expedition. Maybe it was like, oh, it was a dumb one. So now the Nimrod is going to be synonymous with moron.
No, because they actually did really well. So I
Oh,
don't,
okay. Well,
yeah.
then never mind. Forget I said anything.
So interesting, though, that the expedition kind of lacked institutional support and was funded by individual contributions. And in some ways, it was viewed as a slight to Scott. But in addition, Shackleton had put his home base in McMurdo Sound, which was the location of the discovery hut from the prior expedition that Scott did. And Shackleton promised Scott that he wouldn't put it there, and then he ended up putting it there because it was like the easiest place to put it. So that was viewed as a slight. This expedition attempted the pole by climbing up the Beardmore Glacier from the Ross Ice Shelf. They had brought sledding dogs and brought the first ponies to Antarctica to try to get at the South Pole. Shackleton managed to reach the quote unquote high latitude of 88 degrees south, so that's 2 degrees from the pole, before being forced to turn back by a lack of food.
Okay.
This was the furthest South Pole attempt made up until this point. During this time, another group in his party actually made it to the magnetic South Pole. So remember, so the actual latitude South Pole, the physical South Pole, and the magnetic South Pole are two
Oh,
different locations.
that's very true.
Yeah. So another group in his party made it to the magnetic South Pole. One of the members being the Australian explorer Douglas Mawson, who we later talk about in one of our episodes as well. So all of these guys are so like interconnected. Like everybody knows everybody, all these big names in Antarctic exploration, which makes it kind of fun.
That is really fun. I looked up Nimrod
Well, hold
if you
on.
wanna
Hold on a sec.
take.
All right. All right, so you looked up Nimrod.
I did if you wanna do an aside, or we can do it at the
Yeah,
end of the
we can do
episode.
it aside.
So this is all, I pulled it from Wikipedia, just quick Google search, whatever. The term Nimrod is sometimes used in English to mean either a tyrant or a skillful hunter. In modern North American English, the term Nimrod is often used to mean a dim-witted or stupid person, a usage perhaps first recorded in an 1836 letter from Robert E. Lee to a female friend. Lee describes a young Nimrod from the West who, in declining an appointment to West Point, expressed the concern that, quote, "I hope my country will not be endangered by my doing so," unquote. Although Lee may have been sarcastically referring to the student as a tyrant or skillful hunter, the modern usage more closely fits his message. The nickname Nimrod was used mockingly in the 1914 novel by Robert Tressel in The Ragged. The nickname Nimrod was used mockingly in the 1914 novel by Robert Tressel and The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists. The sarcastic moniker was used towards the foreman named Hunter of a gang of workmen as a play both on his surname and his supposed religious beliefs and sense of self-importance. Other than Lee's letter and the Tressel novel, the first recorded use of Nimrod in this meaning was in 1932. The usage is often said to have been popularized by the Looney Tunes cartoon character Bugs Bunny, sarcastically referring to the hunter Elmer Fudd as a Nimrod to highlight the difference between Mighty Hunter and poor little Nimrod. However, it is in fact Daffy Duck who refers to Fudd as My Little Nimrod in the 1948 short, What Makes Daffy Duck? Although Bugs Bunny does refer to Yosemite Sam as the Little Nimrod in the 1951 short, Rabbit Every Monday. Both episodes were voiced by Mel Blanc and produced by Edward Sizer, however you pronounce his last name. But that's a little fun. If you want to add more people in there, Robert E. Lee and Looney Tunes. So.
So that's, yeah. So started to get a name. And then I feel like, yeah, that the Looney Tunes probably cemented it as like synonymous with moron.
Yeah.
But Looney
But
Tunes did not happen until after this.
yeah, I
So
was gonna say,
there's a
long story
timeline.
short, nowhere does it mention the boat or the ship, I guess, because
Right.
boats are different than ships.
Well, so yeah. So this was, oh no, we talked about that. So Shackleton's achievements on this expedition set him up to be a national hero upon return, kind of giving him an equal polar profile to Scott, where he didn't have that before. And so now they're kind of like, I wouldn't say competitors, but like there's a little like vibe of animosity there. But he didn't make it to the pole. So Scott planned a second expedition, which left Britain in 1910 with the goals of scientific expedition and claiming the South Pole for Britain. American explorer Robert Peary had reached the North Pole the prior year, so many were turning their attention to the South, because that hadn't been claimed.
Yeah.
Right. So the Terra Nova arrived in McMurdo Sound on January 4th, 1911, landing on Ross Island. Within a fortnight, the expedition had built a hut or living quarters on Cape Evans and had all of their supplies and stores moved in. The hut was at the foot of Erebus, which is the volcano that was named after the HMS Erebus, which is the ship that ended up carrying Sir John Franklin and his crew into the high Arctic. So there's just layers and layers and layers here.
Like an onion.
Yeah, the ship and the crew disappeared for over a century before it was found in, I think, 2014 or 2016. So that's where that volcano gets its name from.
Yeah.
By January 18th, the expedition had moved into the hut, which was far roomier than the word hut describes. It was like a big bunkhouse, basically, with like room for scientific work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Scientific objectives for the expedition included studying the continent. So, besides the main South Pole party, there were several other smaller parties that were sent to survey the coasts adjacent to Ross Island as well. And those all have their own crazy ass survival stories.
Like Ross Island does?
Like the other parties that were sent out during this big expedition
Oh,
have their
oh.
own. So, like, I can do episodes on those too.
Yeah,
That's how
episodes on
much.
episodes on episodes.
Yes. Like, an Arctic exploration, especially at this time, is just like a wealth of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about South Pole. So they brought with them 19 Manchurian ponies from Siberia and 33 dogs and three motor sledges, which were like these new tracked sleds with like gas-powered engines. They look like little tanks.
Oh,
And I
really?
think they were later used to develop tanks.
Oh,
They're
okay.
like a tank prototype,
That's
basically.
interesting.
And you can scroll down to see the pictures.
Yeah, I was doing that, but then I was losing place on like where you were speaking, so I
Yeah,
was like,
so
okay.
that's the motor sledge.
Which one is that? The third, four, five,
You'll know
four.
it when you
Yeah,
see
right
it.
there. I see it. Yeah, there it is.
And then beneath that are the little ponies that they brought,
Oh, the little ponies.
which
That
is.
sledge thing. So it's like if you have ever seen what are those, like a caterpillar cat, not like the animal, like the machine, like the construction machine where it's like it's on that like wheelie base thing.
Yeah.
It's like one wheel is like the base of this
Yeah.
motor sledge.
It's
I don't
a
know how
it
to describe that. That
it
was like
kind of
an awful
reminds
way to
me of my
describe
dad's
it.
track chair, to be honest, like a
Oh
bigger version. Because
yeah.
he has so my dad's a quadriplegic. You know, that's a story we can get into another time. Haley knows it. But if you've been on this podcast long enough, you know. And so we have a track chair for him that's a wheelchair with tire like tank tracks, basically. So
Yeah.
you can go like off road with it, which is
That's
cool.
really cool. Yeah, like on
That's
the beach or
exactly
something.
kind of what this looks like.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, about these motor sledges, though, they lost one trying to get it to shore. But then they realized that the two remaining sledges were useless in the Antarctic because the extreme cold made the sledges temperamental at best and unable to function at worst, which, if you're like halfway to the pole away from any kind of supplies, that's not what you want to
No.
be dealing with. So,
Yeah, never.
using the sledges was actually quickly abandoned, and Scott turned his attention to using dogs, ponies, and man hauling. And the goal was to follow Shackleton's route and method to get to the South Pole because he had already done it. So they
Yeah.
knew where they were going, at the very least.
Yeah, they just needed like more supplies, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like we know where we're going, we just need to make sure we prepare better, kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So go back to our Norwegian friend, Roald. Roly.
Rolly. Roly poly oly.
So he had originally planned to try to get to the North Pole for Norway. However, because Robert Perry beat him to it in 1909, that wasn't happening anymore. So he had actually been planning the expedition to the North Pole when Robert Perry beat him to it. So he quickly pivoted, adjusting his gear, men, and dogs for a secret South Pole attempt instead.
Oh, that's interesting. He was
yeah, because he's like, well, I already have the supplies, so let's
fucking
do this
thing. I'm
gonna
pull a fast one on you guys.
Yeah.
Huh.
So the this change was such a surprise and kept so secretive that in October of 1910, just as they all thought they were on their way to the North Pole, Amundsen surprised his men, revealing his master plan to go for the South Pole instead.
Get the fuck out of here. He was like, aha, we're not doing that.
Yeah. He reasoned with his...
They're all there like, oh, this is cool. We're going to the North Pole. La-di-da. And then he's like, oh, nope, just kidding. This
Joke's on you, motherfuckers. Let's
Joke's
do
on you.
So,
oh God, I wonder how many of them were pissed. I'd be so pissed.
They were
like, I told my family I was going here. What if something happens? They're gonna look for me in the wrong place. Oh my God.
So he reasoned with them like en route, saying that they would be more likely to beat the British as they were planning to ski to the pole, whereas the British planned on doing man hauling for a majority of it. So with skis, the Norwegians would be like physically faster, and they had like skiing experts with them, because it's cross-country skiing is like a national pastime in Norway. It's like their thing.
Yeah.
You know? So while this was a surprise to everyone, Amundsen finally felt like he needed to let Scott know his intentions.
Yeah.
So he drafted a telegram merely stating going south, and Scott connected the dots because he knew Amundsen was a polar explorer. So he realized that Amundsen's plans had changed and realized that they were in for a race. Later, Amundsen sent the telegram, "Beg to inform you, Fram preceding Antarctica, Amundsen." And the Fram was their ship. So now it's very clear what he's doing.
Yeah.
So Amundsen and the Norwegians reached Antarctica in January of 1911 as well, landing in the Bay of Whales, and quickly set up their hut and headquarters, dubbed Framheim, after the ship, and began unloading all of their stores from the ship. Of his decision to go to the South Pole instead of the North Pole, Amundsen said, "Nor did I feel any great scruples in regard to the other Antarctic expeditions that were being planned at the time. I knew I should be able to inform Captain Scott of the extension of my plans before he left civilization, and therefore a few months sooner or later could be of no great importance. Scott's plan and equipment were so wildly different from my own that I regarded the telegram that I sent him later with the information that we were bound for the Antarctic regions rather as a mark of courtesy. The British expedition was designed entirely for scientific research. The pole was only a side issue, whereas in my extended plan, it was the main object." So he's saying like, hey, I did this as a courtesy. But ultimately, I kind of agree with him on this. Like, nobody has a claim to the pole.
Yeah.
So the British are all getting ruffling their feathers because they're British and they think everything belongs to them. Right. Just because they're like, yeah, we have a guy down there. So I'm kind of like, I'm with Evans. I'm like, whatever, man. Like, you do you. Like, nobody owns this continent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even to this day, nobody owns this continent.
No, it's just down there.
Like,
well, I'm like, what would people do if they owned it, honestly? Like, it's so uninhabitable.
Right. Well, they'd probably drill for resources, actually.
That's true.
That's what they would do.
Yeah,
so.
They'd ruin it that way.
True. But at the time, like, you know, but like, seriously. So, of course, this was not at all accurate. Scott had not hidden their intentions to reach the South Pole. Like, that was the objective. But their first objective, however, outside of the other scientific expeditions, was to lay supply depots for the journey south. So that they would have enough resources, basically. In between the team at Cape Evans and the pole, there were several huge obstacles. As Cape Evans was on Ross Island, the polar party would have to cross the barrier, which is this large section of the Ross Sea covered with a permanent ice shelf. Although there was a narrow section of sea ice between the island and the shelf that kind of thaws during the summer, so that would have been a little tricky. Once they reached the land on the coast, they would have to climb up the Beardmore Glacier as a way of bypassing the Transantarctic Mountains and then onto the Polar Plateau, which is a large, flat, endless ice cap that is considered like the coldest place on Earth. And that's where the pole is. So that's their route.
So how far away did you say is the true South Pole from the magnetic South Pole?
I actually don't know off the top of my head, but I think it's like a couple hundred miles.
Okay.
So there,
Thank
yeah.
you.
I mean, you can look up, like, let's see, how far South Pole from magnetic?
2,858 kilometers.
That
Wait.
is the distance between the North and the South Pole, I think.
It says the distance between the South Geographic Pole and the South Magnetic Pole is approximately 2,858
Oh,
kilometers.
so a lot, a big difference. So basically, the difference between the true South Pole is a location on a map, right? It's what we've
Yeah.
decided is the true, like, farthest south latitude, basically, on the planet.
1,775.879 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's like how, the four corners in the States, it's not like where the four corners like monument is not actually the true four corners of where all those states meet.
Oh, yeah.
Just
Yeah,
because, I don't know.
yep. Maps are weird. Well, and so the magnetic South Pole is what all of your compasses are going
Go
away from,
to
I guess, because our compasses point towards magnetic north. And
North,
then so
yeah.
the exact opposite would be the magnetic south. So that's the pole of the magnetic field that surrounds the planet. So that's, and they're different. And that's why they're
Yeah.
different. Yeah, big distances we're talking about though. So on January 24th, 1911, the expedition left for their depot journey, which was an adventure in and of itself. They left as soon as they could because as the summer wore on, the thaw on the barrier or the Ross Ice Shelf would only get worse, and crossing would become more dangerous and just physically difficult because it's much harder to walk in wet, melting snow than like firm snow, right? So they set off with 8 ponies, 2 dog teams, and 12 men for hauling supplies. They first arrived at the old Discovery Hut, which served as Shackleton's main base during his pole attempt, and that's where Scott's first expedition launched from. So this hut was about 15 miles from Cape Evans on Ross Islands, and it was at the very end of a peninsula. So the hut itself was in like remarkable condition. Because while everything was frozen, the supplies that they had left behind were still good, and it seemed untouched, almost like Shackleton had just like stepped out, you know.
Oh.
So they were actually able to beef up their own stores of food and fodder for the ponies from what Shackleton had left, as it had been perfectly preserved in the cold for years.
Gotcha. That's
So
interesting.
the Antarctic has a very and. These places to this day are still like this. Like
Yeah.
you could go there now and it would look the same as it did in the early 1900s. And
Yeah, and that's like God, we just talked about this a couple episodes ago, like the fucking like Alaska, that area up there with like the ice caps melting and the woolly mammoths and
Oh yeah.
whatever, the
Like the
kelp,
permafrost.
yeah, the kelp bridges and things like that. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's
So
like kind of similar.
it's incredibly cool because you can actually still go see it the same way Scott or Shackleton might have seen it.
Yeah, that's really cool to know that
Yeah.
that's possible.
So they've become like historical landmarks now at this point.
Yeah.
So after they began relaying supplies from Cape Evans to the Discovery Hut, they made their way out onto the barrier itself, and they found buried in the snow more tents left behind from the Shackleton expedition, most likely left on their way back from the pole attempt. This trip showed how difficult Antarctic travel could be, as the Depot expedition experienced storms with whiteout conditions in which, if someone exposed their skin, they would immediately get frostbite. In addition, due to melt, the surface of the barrier was soft and was difficult for the ponies to walk on. And so they talked about potentially making snowshoes for the ponies.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, which I think is hilarious and very cute.
I like the first thing that comes to my head is like, those dog shoes were like the
Yeah.
trail shoes.
The
Like,
boots.
imagine if ponies had those types of boots.
They're just like walking with their legs up a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do have little duties for ponies, to help like protect their feet, when you're
Oh.
like riding and sporting or like in competition, stuff like that. Like, we put boots on ponies all the time.
Yeah.
So, because also the barrier was white and flat and often misty from wind and drifting snow, they also experienced mirages all the time. So things far off would seem very, very close, and like vice versa. So they'd see what they thought was a group of men and dogs, and then they'd walk a couple of feet forward, and it was just a pile of dog shit.
Oh, God.
Like, that's how like weird things looked out on the barrier,
Oh, my
because
God.
it's just this big white featureless place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, that must make you gotta go crazy too, you know?
Not to mention, because they're doing this in the Antarctic summer, the sun's up all the time.
Yeah, so then you lose track of the hours of the day.
Yep.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that must be a
Yeah.
lot.
Yeah. So, in addition, the farther south they went, they would not be able to rely on the compass as much, because it was directing towards magnetic south instead of true south. So compasses became unreliable, and it said they would have to take sights on celestial bodies like the sun.
That's freaky.
They also regularly encountered crevices or crevasses in the ice, sometimes with entire teams of dogs falling into the crevasses, where the dogs hung in their harnesses in the abyss, suspended between the sledge and the leading dog. And that was from Scott's diary. So they'd regularly
Yeah.
have to rescue the dogs from these fissures, because they'd just be hanging there, right?
Oh, God, that's scary.
Scott himself even went down into a crevasse to rescue two dogs from a ledge. And like I said, he was known to care a great deal for all the animals on his roster. And so he was always very concerned about the dogs and the ponies. And this was a trait he had carried on from being
Yeah.
a sensitive young boy, which I like. I mean, I kind of feel the same way, right?
Yeah.
So while Shackleton had successfully used ponies on his trip, Scott's men were having less luck. The ponies, even on the depot journey, were in bad shape upon return, and I think only one or two of the ponies managed to survive the depot trip. Now, they didn't take all the
Oh.
ponies with them, but they took at least eight, right? So that's it's pretty significant.
Did they end up eating the ponies if they didn't survive?
Not yet.
Okay.
I
I'm curious.
they may, I think, I don't know, I can't remember, but we'll get
This seems like
to
something that would have happened if
Yeah.
they had ponies. You know what I
Basically,
mean?
what happened is these ponies were just exhausted, right? Because
Yeah.
during the storms, they would try to protect the ponies by building up walls of like supplies between them and the wind. But the ponies were exposed to the elements the entire time they were out there. Like, they
Gotcha.
didn't have tents. They weren't like the dog. The dogs would build their own little snow hole and sleep there because
Yeah.
they're huskies, right? The ponies were just fucking out there. It's not a natural place for a pony to be.
No, I mean, even in farmland, they cover them up like on with those like blankets
Yeah.
when it's colder out, and then they have them go in the barn. Like, I mean, my aunt has a farm and they board horses and they have like heated horse stalls and everything like that.
Right.
Like,
Right. Yeah, and like, so these ponies were like from Siberia, so they were better
more prone
suited.
to, yeah,
But at
more
the same time,
resilient.
it's like this is a place where no terrestrial animals live, period.
And like they're not meant to live there either,
No.
you know?
And it's like, I almost feel like they should have brought reindeer to pull
Yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, that
The
makes
caribou.
sense. Yeah.
But, I
Or
mean,
moose.
so they have ponies.
Or like bison. I don't know.
Yeah, muskox. I don't know. Can you tame a muskox?
Probably not.
So, reindeer, though, because we've tamed reindeer, I feel
Yeah.
like that would have made a little bit more sense. They're a little bit better prepared. So there was talk of killing the ponies as food for the dogs and laying them at a depot for the polar party to use the next year. In one case, one of the dog teams became so hungry that they preyed on one of the weaker horses. Like they
Oh
just
my
went nuts.
God.
The goal of the depot exposition was to lay what they called 1-ton depot, because it was 1 ton of supplies at latitude 80 south. They ended up setting the depot about 37 miles north of their target at 79 degrees 29 minutes south. And so this ton of provisions also included oil for like their stoves, which was extremely important because if you didn't have oil, you can't cook.
Yeah.
You just have a frozen block of whatever you're trying to eat. So this would play into problems for them later on down the road. The fact
Okay.
that they didn't lay it right at 80 degrees south. But we'll probably get into that next episode.
What kind of problems?
I'm not gonna tell you.
Like magnetic problems?
Well, let's just say problems for them because navigating is now so hard because you can't use a compass, you know, you can't. So if you get a celestial like measurement wrong, it could fuck up where like your knowledge of where you're at, basically.
Yeah.
So navigating in here is very important because if you don't reach your depot, your supply depot, you may be fucked, right?
Yes.
Because there's nothing else for you to use.
Yes.
There's nothing here, right? So I'll just give that.
Okay.
All right. So on the 12th of February, after they like laid the 1-ton depot, the parties started to turn around and then go back to the hut at Cape Evans for the summer. And this depot was 130 miles away from the island, basically.
Gotcha.
So the return to their home base included more blizzards, more dog teams falling into crevasses, and two ponies dying just from exhaustion.
Oh, God.
Five more ponies and their human handlers became trapped on a floe of sea ice on the barrier, and they were preyed upon by orca whales.
Oh,
And they did
no.
this
Jeez.
much in the same manner that orca whales like hunt seals that are on like icebergs, where they'll like go under really fast and create a wave to try to knock the seal off
Yeah.
of the ice. But they were doing this with ponies.
Oh my
So if you
God.
ever wanted to know if a killer whale has eaten a horse, it has. So,
There's probably just like a single pod out there that have been part of that, but nonetheless, they have.
So the men and the ponies were trapped on the ice floe overnight before any of them were able to be rescued, and only one pony survived this ordeal. All the men did, but only one's pony survived. So
Goodness.
all of this upset paled in comparison to the note that was left to Scott from the other members of the expedition who explored the Bay of Whales on the coast while the others were laying depots. So this group of men had found Roald Amundsen and his expedition preparing for a polar trip as well. So they knew he was coming down, but they didn't expect to like find him right next door, right?
Yeah.
So many of the team were angry about this, saying, "We felt, however unreasonably, that we had earned the first right of way." And this is from Cherry Garrard, who was the author of The Worst Journey in the World. This was from his words. So
Gotcha.
a group of Scott's crew were sent on the Terra Nova to survey the eastern edge of the ice shelf to find another location to put a hut for further exploration of the area. When they found Amundsen's Framheim on February 3rd, 1911, they knew Amundsen intended to take the South Pole, but they did not know where he planned on landing, and they were very surprised to find his home base only 400 miles away from their own, which sounds like a big distance, but in the span of the Antarctic continent, it's not that big.
Yeah.
Each group took advantage of this meeting to size up the competition. So it turned out that neither team had brought in a wireless radio, which was relatively new technology at the time. And therefore, the group that got back to civilization first with a polar claim would win the notoriety. So that was interesting. The British team was dismayed and impressed by the number of sled dogs Amundsen had, which was more than 100 dogs to the Brits' 30, and they planned on running the dog teams and skiing alongside them, so they could really make some good speed with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he
Fast
had
as
very
fuck,
skilled,
boy.
yeah. So he had very skilled dog drivers and champion skiers on his expedition team. In contrast, the British crew were almost all military men, sometimes learning skills along the way from more experienced polar men. So they didn't have like an expertise in
Yeah.
these specific like polar survival skills. Even though Scott's men knew the motorized sledges weren't going to be part of the polar push, they did brag about them to the Norwegians just to keep them on their toes. Amundsen was also about 60 miles closer to the pole than the British, giving him a 60-mile head start. Which, I mean, that's where he
Pretty
chose.
decent. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where he chose to be. So, Scott said about Amundsen, "There is no doubt Amundsen's plan is a serious menace to ours. He has a shorter distance to the pole by 60 miles. He can't start his journey early in the season, or he can, sorry, he can start his journey earlier in the season, an impossible condition with ponies." The members of the Scott expedition also found out that Amundsen, like them, was not planning a polar attempt till the following year. So they're literally going to be neck and neck for this thing.
Yeah. The
So
race is on.
yeah, the race is on. So Campbell, one of Scott's men, described the Norwegians as inured to hardship, good goers, and pleasant and good humored. All these qualities combined to make them very dangerous rivals. But even did one want to, one cannot help to like them individually in spite of that rivalry. So they were finding camaraderie because they're all very similar people,
Yeah.
right? So like very specific people want to go do this kind of thing. It was at this point they knew that it was likely they would need two teams to reach the pole next year. But who would get there first was up in the air. Terry Garrard stated, "We had all underrated Amundsen, and we could not shake off the feeling that he had stolen the march on us."
Oh.
So we're setting up this sort of rivalry. Amundsen got a later start on supply depot laying than Scott's team, bringing their first or beginning their first depot run on February 10th. Amundsen did have a unique disadvantage to Scott. Unlike Scott, who was traveling over land that Shackleton had traversed before his pole attempt, Amundsen was in completely uncharted territory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Don't know
Amundsen
where he's
stated,
going.
yeah, so they really didn't know what obstacles they could expect. So we could not tell even approximately how long the journey would take, as everything ahead was unknown. So they do have some disadvantages in comparison to the Brits as well. Their first depot trip went well. The four men on skis with their dog teams were making great time over the landscape, covering 2 to 3 times more ground than Scott's team could average in a day. And this is based off of what we know now. At one point, it was quote unquote so warm that Amundsen took his reindeer pants off, just skiing in a shirt and undergarments. And that was 12 degrees Fahrenheit. So still pretty cold, but I guess it's all relative.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was one winter back home where it was so cold. My dad said that when it finally got to be like 30 degrees Fahrenheit, he was like outside in a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Because it was just like the difference. He's like, oh,
Yeah.
30 degrees doesn't feel that cold. So I imagine that's a similar scenario. where it's been so cold for so long that when it reaches 12 degrees Fahrenheit, he's like, man, it's like a summer day out here.
Right. Plus they're Norwegian, so, you know, they're like used to it, right?
Yeah.
So they did find that their ski boots were wearing down in the Antarctic conditions, so they would have to repair them using seal skin boots pioneered
seal,
by the
seal skin.
Seal, seal you skin.
Did, you did it boots. Twice. You...
pioneered by the Inuit called Kamiks. On their first effort, they lay a depot at 81 degrees south. So already on their first depot, they are way farther south than, or at 1 degree farther than Scott's team.
Gotta tell you, I do love the Inuit culture.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you go to Alaska and you go to Kenai Fjords, like their junior ranger booklets and things like that, they talk about the Inuit culture.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool. So.
Well, and it's like, it feels like the natural thing to do if you're going to go to a pole to take advantage of like life advice and information from people who live in like that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So,
and I believe they are the only culture that is allowed to eat seals
and whales.
And whales, yeah. Because,
well, it depends on the country, but in the United States, yes.
Yeah, I remember seeing some sort of, I don't know, article or TikTok or whatever from like an Inuit woman about like, you know, we eat seal meat, and someone in the comments was like, I thought that was illegal. And then she was like, oh no, like Inuits are still allowed to do that. They have, well, you know,
native exceptions. It's cultural. They've been surviving on that for like thousands of years. And just because white people came and ruined like the fishery by over hunting the animals, like, so we have to punish everybody. Like, yeah, no.
Oops.
So back to the Antarctic where nobody lives. The second depot drop Amundsen did was at 82 degrees south, but it did turn out to be more costly. So 8 men and 42 dogs set out the second time. And Amundsen noticed that the rough ice was cutting into the dogs' paws, injuring them. So he began to get concerned with the dog's health. However, they managed to lay a second depot at 82 degrees south and expected an easier trip home with empty sledges. Unfortunately, due to cold temperatures of minus 26 degrees Fahrenheit, the dogs couldn't sleep, and now they were exhausted and injured. They ended up losing 8 dogs by the time they arrived back at Framheim on March 22nd.
Aww.
But the loss was somewhat compensated, as 22 puppies had been born back at Framheim and would be trained for the polar trip over the winter. The third depot trip laid almost 4 tons of supplies at 83 degrees south. I put Fahrenheit, but it's south. So all in all, over 7,500 pounds of supplies had been laid at all 3 depots. And their preparations for the spring's following pole attempt was done for the season. So they've laid depots 3 degrees farther south. They've got way more supplies.
Yeah.
And while they probably came out about the same as far as like losing animals' life was concerned, like it seems like they're a little bit better set up than the British, except they don't know what else is going to be in their way.
Gotcha.
So this is where we're at.
Gotcha.
So Amundsen was meticulous with marking these depots with black flags marking each kilometer of their trip in order to prevent losing the location of the caches, as they would be snowed over by the time spring came. So this was
Big were these flags? Because if it's just like those ground stake flags, wouldn't that get snowed over too?
Probably. I'm assuming they were bigger. I don't know.
I would hope they're bigger.
Yeah. I can't say for sure though.
Yeah. And also, how do you say that word? Is it cache or is it caches? Because I
have no idea.
I lean towards the cache side.
Cache.
Because of like geocaching, that's like how they say it. Like that's how they say geocaching. Whoa, Jesus Christ, Marzi.
That's the doorbell. I think we're going to have to stop or pause for a second.
Okay, yeah, just pause for a second. We're good.
I'm back, everyone. Hi.
They
It's
don't know
been,
that you were just gone for 3 hours. It's
yeah, I
fine.
was literally gone for 3 hours. You guys won't know. It'll literally be like what cut from one to the other, but I am like 3 hours into this water mess headache. I am now drinking a ranch water because it's fucking 4 o'clock here,
Good. I
and
almost pulled
I
out a Modelo, okay, but I have a
so I
Coke
ended up having to run to Victoria, which is about 35 minutes away from us, to get a dehumidifier for the master bedroom
Zero. Yeah.
because all of the water is under the floor, so it's not like a fan is gonna actually do anything.
Yeah,
So
you need to like dry it
dehumidifier it
out.
was. So we were literally two sentences away from being done
Yeah,
with my
how funny is
session.
that?
Okay. So we got through, we talked about Amundsen marking the flags for all the depots so that they knew where they were. So
Yeah.
reminding you, this is like a flat, featureless plane, right? The barrier. There's no real like markers for anything. They're having issues with like mirages and that kind of thing as well. So like markers are important. They also are having problems navigating because the magnetic South Pole is messing with their compasses.
Yeah.
And so he was very, very meticulous about this because if you miss a depot, again, there is nothing out there to sustain you. Period. End of statement.
Well, and also we don't know how big these markers were, because if they're like little utility flags, those things will get blown away or snowed over real
Yeah.
easily.
I
So
have to
I'm
think they were
hoping that they're bigger.
sizable. I
Yeah.
have to think, based on what I know, they must have been sizable. I mean,
I just like I'm imagining if they are sizable, I'm just imagining like in my head they're like nailing down like a 5 foot pole and then like tying a decent sized flag to it, like bigger than a sheet of paper.
Right. I mean, these guys have explored the Arctic before, so I feel like they're gonna come and do all of this. They would bring all the stuff for it, right?
Yeah.
So,
I was just trying to like visualize it. I was trying
right.
like that's why I was asking how big the flag was, because I was like, if it's
So
teeny.
at this point, both Scott and Emerson's teams had laid their supply depots. And so now all that was left for each team to do was to wait out the Antarctic winter until temperatures became warmer in spring. So attempting to reach the pole in winter would have been basically a suicide for both teams, and both Amundsen and Scott knew that because temperatures on the coast plummeted like it way into the negatives. In the interior of the continent is expected to be much colder, which, knowing what we know about weather, usually coastal areas are a lot milder than interior parts of the country. So let's just, like, for shits and giggles, how cold is it at South Pole? So in winter, the average temperature at the South Pole is negative 76 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh my goodness.
That's the average.
No, thank you.
So, and you'd be doing it all in the dark. Suicide, right?
Yeah.
So, all they could do at this point was wait back at their bases and overwinter. Scott and Amundsen were about to set out into the unknown to do something no human had ever done before. And as the frigid Antarctic winter closed in around them, one could not help but feel the feeling of fate that lay ahead of them. Soon they would race to their goal, and only one of them would return. And
Uh-oh.
so that's the setup for the second round. And I just
Okay.
felt like I really wanted to like go into all that was actually involved in making these expeditions happen and all of the like weird petty drama that surrounded this whole incident, because it makes the outcome that much more devastating. So we'll talk about their South Pole, both of their South Pole trips, in the next episode and kind of the fallout and aftermath of
Okay.
what happened. So,
We got ourselves a little bit of a cliffhanger here.
yeah, you know, make your bets. If you don't know, don't go look it up
Yeah.
and place your bets. So yeah, so that is our South Pole race setup here.
Cool.
And lots of facts, lots of numbers, but you get the idea of how
Yeah.
each team is kind of set up to succeed and like what obstacles are in their way. You know. So yeah, I guess I should actually do my sources because last week I forgot to. Again, this is a chronic problem for me.
Oh, did you? Whoops. I
Oh
didn't even
yeah.
notice.
So most of this information came from The Worst Journey in the World by Apsley Cherry Garrard, which is such a name. It's a vibe.
Gerard.
And this is a book. And then the Amundsen expedition timeline and the Robert Scott expedition timeline from the American Museum of Natural History. And then Southpole.com had these really long biopsies on Robert Falcon Scott and Roald Amundsen that were really useful in kind of getting like the background info on both of these guys, how they were raised, what they were like.
Gotcha.
So yeah, so that's the citations.
Cool. Good deal.
Yeah.
Well, I was looking into some endangered animals in Antarctica, and I'm staying away from the birds to spare us all more birds.
At some point, you
And
can come back to the birds.
I know. Well, so I found this website. I think I all honestly, I think I just Googled like endangered animals in Antarctica. And so on coolantarctica.com/a bunch of things, but I'm sure if you just go to coolantarctica.com, you'll get there. They have some common names, scientific names, their status, their estimated population, and then their population trend. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I wonder if I can pick one that's like their population trend is decreasing, or like if they're endangered, their population's at least increasing kind of thing. So the two that I picked to kind of like chat about, one is the sei whale, SEI whale. They are endangered. Their population is estimated to be around 30,000 whales, and their population trend is unknown. And then the blue whale. They're endangered. Their population's estimated to be about 10,000 to 25,000 whales, and then their population trend is increasing. So the sei whale and the blue whale are big long boys.
Big ol' log boys.
And sei whale is a baleen whale, so I don't know if anybody has ever seen what baleen looks like. It's like that, I don't know, like straw looking type of thing, teeth stuff.
It's actually like keratin.
Yeah.
So it's like the same shit as your fingernails or your
And like your
hair,
hair. Yeah,
just
yeah.
like hanging down from their mouth,
Yeah,
basically.
they're just hang sound from their mouth. That just like made me feel icky.
Yeah, just think about having a big old clump of hair in your mouth at all times, but
Yeah.
you can use it to catch shrimp, so.
And like, yeah, filters all the plankton and krill
Yeah.
out. So sei whales occur in subtropical, temperate, and subpolar waters around the world, often found with pollock in Norway. The name sei comes from the Norwegian word for pollock, which is looks like the how you would say sei,
Yeah,
honestly.
I'm pretty sure it's pronounced say whale.
Yeah,
Yeah.
because the way that it's spelled is SEI, but then the Norwegian word for pollock is SEJE. So
Yeah. I feel like
going
I've
with
always pronounced
sales.
it say,
Yeah.
personally. Could
Let me
be
know if I can
wrong.
get a, let me get a
Say whale.
sei whale. Yep.
There you go.
Okay. So the global sei whale population was greatly decreased by historical commercial whaling during the 19th and 20th centuries. An estimated 300,000 sei whales were killed for their meat and oil. Member countries of the International Whaling Commission, or the IWC, agreed to cease sei whale catches in the North Pacific in 1975 and in the Antarctic in 1979, which was not that long ago.
Nope.
In 1982, the IWC decided to cease commercial whaling on all whale species and populations from the 1985/1986 season onward. Again, not that long ago.
No. Well, and there's still whaling going on. I just don't know like what the legality behind it is.
Right. Yeah. Although whaling is no longer a major threat, some whaling of this species continues today in Japan. There you go. Figured it'd be something like Japan because they also killed dolphins. Vessel strikes and entanglement pose the biggest threat to sei whales today. The sei whale is listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act and depleted under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. No, if, and then because I am reading all of this off of NOAA, so it's
Yay.
fisheries.noaa.gov. Yeah, so it's credible source. So then,
Wikipedia, everyone shits on Wikipedia, but I'm like, do you know how quickly those people change facts when somebody goes in and thinks it's funny to like make the capital of like, I don't know, Idaho, like Paris or something? Like they get on that shit quick. They're
I mean, I
always
trust
watching out.
Wikipedia. I think like at the beginning of Wikipedia time, we were told not to trust it, but like as it's gotten better over the years, it's gotten a little bit more
It's gotten
credible.
significantly better, you
Yeah.
know. Sorry.
No, you're good. I just this next sentence mentioned NOAA, so I just like was like, oh, this is probably just because it's on their website. And I should probably mention that I'm pulling it from their website. But so NOAA Fisheries and their partners are dedicated to conserving and rebuilding the sei whale population. They use a variety of innovative techniques to study, protect, and rescue the endangered whale species. They engage their partners as they develop regulations and management plans that foster healthy fisheries and reduce the risk of entanglements, create whale-safe shipping practices, and reduce ocean noise. Because that's something, too, that I don't think a lot of people think about is like the echolocation between ocean noise, like the ship's noises, and then the animals that have echolocation. That actually like impacts them negatively sometimes. So.
I mean, it's like having a big satellite dish in your head, and if there's additional like intense noises, like from large barges or, you know, from oil drilling, like oil rigs and stuff like that, like I feel like it would be difficult to do what you need to do.
So let's talk about what they look like. Sei whales have long, sleek bodies that are dark bluish gray to black in color and white or cream colored on the underside. So that is the counter shading that you learn about in school. And that's because when you look up as a fish, their white belly blends in with the sun on the surface. And then when you look down as a fish, their blue, dark blue, blackish body blends in with the bottom of the ocean colors.
Well,
So,
okay, and I gotta
but
add something, 'cause counter shading makes sense when you're a small fish. Why would a whale
like when
have
you're
counter
big,
shading?
I know. Yeah, I know. It's, but
I know
it,
what
that,
the answer to that is. It's because they used to be hunted by Megalodon and other huge, massive sperm whales that were so fucking big, they could hunt full-sized baleen whales.
no shit. I did not know that.
So it's like a remnant of a time when predators were much bigger.
Oh, that's really cool. I just got chills. That's cool. It's
Okay.
like that evolutionary trait never
Like went
evolutionary
away.
I went away. Yeah. Can't speak 'cause I'm so stoked about that. That's a fun fact. Yeah,
Okay,
I mean
sorry.
like 'cause that's why no, you're good. That's why you're here 'cause I'm not as smart as you. But that's interesting you say that because like yeah, sharks have counter shading and that's like yeah, counter shading is like, you know, a defense mechanism on animals. So, that's
And
super
camouflage.
interesting. Yeah, and camouflage.
Well, it's also useful camouflage if you're a predator as well, I would add.
Yeah, no, I agree because it's like you can kind of sneak up on them, you know. So yeah, so they got dark on top, light on bottom. Their body is often covered in oval-shaped scars, probably caused from the cookie cutter shark and lamprey bites, and sometimes has a subtle modeling molting mottling. I hate that word.
Modeling, it's like a coloration, like a speckling almost,
Yeah,
or like kind of
speckle.
a
No,
muddy,
yeah, I get that it's like a
smudgy.
speckle. and smudgy kind of thing. But I'm like, why don't you just call it like a speckle or spotted or something? Like mottling, like the way that that's spelled makes me
Mottling.
angry. Like I just, I don't know. I'm just getting angry for no reason over here today. Seawheels have a tall, hooked dorsal fin located about two-thirds down their back. Seawheels have 219 to 410 baleen plates that are made out of keratin, like we talked about, which is also the same material as our fingernails. And they have these instead of teeth. So they have the baleen plates instead of teeth. And they are dark in color with gray or white fine inner fringes on their enormous mouths. They also have 30 to 65 relatively short accordion-like creases or throat grooves that extend from below the mouth to the navel area. The number of throat grooves and baleen plates may differ depending on geographic population. At the water surface, seawheels can be recognized by a columnar or a bushy blow that is about 10 to 13 feet high. That is a long blowhole blow. The dorsal fin usually appears at the same time as the blowhole when the animal surfaces to breathe. Behavior and diet. The sei whales are usually observed alone in small groups of two to five animals. They are fast swimmers that can reach up to speeds of over 34 miles per hour. Golly, I was driving that fast like today. That's insane. Sei whales dive differently than most whales. They do not arch their backs or show their flukes before diving. They simply sink below the surface. They often leave fluke prints, which are smooth circles on the surface created by the movement of the fluke underwater.
They're like, peace.
Yeah, they're like just, they literally just dip out. Like, I'm gone. An average sei whale eats about 2,000 pounds of food per day. They can dive 5 to 20 minutes to feed on plankton, which include copepods and krill. Small schooling fish and cephalopods, which include squid, by both gulping and skimming. They prefer to feed at dawn and may exhibit unpredictable behavior when foraging and feeding on prey.
Yeah, you don't want to be caught if they're it, like if there's a bunch of them feeding, it could get dangerous.
Yeah, I
Remember
would
we
not.
talked
That
about that woman who was on a kayak
kayak, yes. Oh my
and
God.
got swallowed.
And then spit back out. What
Yeah.
a time to be alive. I, oh my God. And they caught it all on film too, because our friend was there. Good God, that was
Yeah.
insane. Okay, so sei whales live in a lot of places. They have a wide distribution. They live in subtropical, temperate, and subpolar waters around the world. They prefer temperate waters in the mid latitudes and can be found in the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans. During the summer, they are commonly found in the Gulf of Maine and on the Georges Bank and Stellwagen Bank of the U.S. coast in the western North Atlantic. The movement patterns of sei whales are not well known, but they are typically observed in deeper waters far as the, excuse me, in deeper waters far from the coastline. Sei whales have unpredictable distribution. Many whales may be found in one area for a period and then not return for years or decades. This behavior is unusual for large whales who generally have a predictable distribution. It is currently unknown where sei whales breed. That's interesting. I didn't know that they didn't know where they bred or like even really knew the whole like behavioral distribution pattern shit.
Yeah,
That's
I feel
interesting.
like we know a lot about the ones that everybody knows about, so like humpbacks and like right whales and stuff like
Yeah.
that. But when it comes to these other whales that are not as like well known, I think there's a lot of questions that have been unanswered by science because A, funding, and B, people just assume we know everything already. And it's like, no,
Yeah, it's like,
but we
no,
don't.
I'm actually really dumb, so
No, it's not even that. It's like we don't have the funding or the manpower to do a lot of these
yeah.
studies. There's so many species, like so many.
Yeah. So
So.
their lifespan and reproduction. Sei whales become sexually mature at 6 to 12 years of age when they reach about 45 feet in length. They generally mate and give birth during the winter in lower latitudes. Females breed every 2 to 3 years with a gestation period of 11 to 13 months.
That's a long
Calves are
time.
about 15 feet long and weigh about 1,500 pounds at birth. Mothers nurse their calves for 6 to 9 months before weaning them off at their preferred feeding grounds.
That's a long gestation period.
That is, I know it sounds horrible. But isn't it like the larger the animal, the longer the gestation period is? Or is that
And you
not?
gotta remember they're being like supported by water and not just
Yeah.
like dealing with gravity with that kind of weight. Like their bodies are supported by water, so it makes it a little bit easier in that sense. And they're also 46 feet long themselves, so, but that's a big fucking baby. Like,
Yeah, 15 feet long. So, like, what is that? Like 15, 30, 45, like a third of its length
yeah,
at birth.
that's a big baby.
That's a big baby. Gross. So, yeah, their threats are vessel strikes, entanglement, ocean noise, and climate change. That's all that really says there under the
Yes,
threats.
yes. I remember there was one time, I might be, completely wrong about this, but I was working with an environmental mitigation group and we were at VIMS, and some guy came running after us when we were leaving to go out. We were like sampling off of Virginia Beach, so out basically in the Atlantic. And this guy was coming out yelling at us about how we messed with his gill nets.
Oh,
And it
get
was
out of
like, well,
here.
first of all, legally, you're not supposed to have gill nets
Yeah,
in the
I'm
area
like,
we're going to. And second of all, we didn't, you can look at our track, like on our GPS. We did not go anywhere near them. And then, like, literally a couple of days later, there was some news article that came out about a humpback whale that got entangled in a gill net. So it probably got
and you're
entangled in
like,
that dude's gill net and
yeah.
just like kept going with it. And he's over here, and I'm like, dude, you could be in so much bigger doo-doo.
Yeah.
Like, that's
Yeah.
jail time, baby. That's jail time.
I mean, honestly, if I had run into that guy and then I saw that article, I'd be on the phone like, hey, you might want to check out this spot right here. If there's not a gill net there, I can tell you who to call. Because.
So, yeah,
That's too
entanglement's a
cool.
big problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think in the context of Antarctica, I think the biggest impacts are probably climate change, but then also like all the like Japanese whale fishing that goes on down
Yeah.
there. I don't know if you remember that show that was on Animal Planet for a while. It's called Whale Wars.
Yeah, I do, but it made me so sad. I couldn't watch it.
I like for a month was like, this is what I'm gonna do. This is gonna be great. I'm gonna be this environmental terrorist. It's gonna be the best. Like, we'll just go fuck with all these ships because that's what Greenpeace was doing. And
Yeah.
then, like, the more you watch it, the more you're like, this is not a good idea
No.
because, like, if somebody dies or like something like that happens, it could be a really huge, like, international incident. And
Yeah.
ultimately, all they were really doing was like ruining the whale meat so it couldn't be used. So the animal still died.
And
I don't
that,
know.
yeah, that show just made me super sad.
So it was still like a complete waste of life,
Yeah,
on
it is.
all
Yeah.
fronts. But
I need to correct myself because when it said that their dorsal fin and their blowhole come up at the same time, I took that to mean that their dorsal was neck like close to their blowhole. It is not. So it's not close to their blowhole. Yeah, the way that it rises is like they just both come up at the same time because like the dorsal is like closer to like the tail fin. It's like on the lower third of its body, and obviously like the blowhole is like the upper third of its body. So my bad guys, I'm an idiot. We already knew that though.
I have made and caught my mistakes so many times that I'm just like, I should really have like a correction corner at the end of every
Correction
episode. Like,
corner.
okay, so last week I said this and that's not actually right, so.
Yeah. It says like under the ESA and NOAA Fisheries develops and implements recovery plans for the conservation and survival of listed species. The recovery plan for the Sei whale was published in December of 2011. The plan aims to recover the species with an interim goal of downlisting the Sei whale status from endangered to threatened. And then it goes into the major actions that are recommended in the plan. And it says reduce or eliminate injury or mortality caused by ship collision, reduce or eliminate injury or and mortality caused by fisheries and fishing gear, protect habitats essential to the survival and recovery of sei whales, minimize effects of vessel disturbance, continue international ban on hunting and other directed take. Monitor the population size and trends in abundance. Maximize efforts to free entangled and stranded sei whales. Acquire scientific information from dead specimens. So, the conservation efforts are reducing vessel strikes, addressing ocean noise, overseeing marine mammal health and stranding response, And then marine mammal unusual mortality events.
Yeah,
Oh,
and
and that's like
again, we're
some
not necessarily
publication I
saying
found
that
too.
like all whaling needs to go away, but like industrialized whaling, yes, needs like it's such a bad practice, and ultimately, like we as a species don't need it anymore. Back
Yeah.
in the day, it's like we used all kinds of stuff from the whales, like the whale oil, the baleen, the meat, all of it. But in today's context, I just don't think that it's necessary because we get all of those things from like synthetic products or other things that we make, right?
Yeah.
And may or may not have negative impacts on the environment, but we don't necessarily like we're smart enough to come up with products to replace those things, essentially, is how I see it. And I think the only whaling that should go on is subsistence, indigenous, you know, whale with the Inuit whalers, for example, because they're literally going out as a team in a canoe, taking one like bowhead whale or one, you know, animal, and then feeding the whole village for, you know, weeks off of that, you know. So it's the same as like hunting buffalo. Like we did it on an industrial scale in the American West, and for thousands of years, Native Americans have been hunting buffalo and didn't deplete them to the numbers that we did. So it's like it's this industrial fishing that is the biggest problem. And this all has come about because of like things like the Industrial Revolution or like the big like technology boom after World War II. And we just got really, really good at extracting resources. And it's just not responsible to do.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that we got a whaling ban, considering how many people just do things for the money, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
This fisheries.noaa.gov site is super useful, honestly. Like they have tabs of like the science behind what they're doing. And then in the conservation and management tab, there was links to some publications of like, projects that have been going on. Like the like Say Whale Recovery Plan was published July 22nd of 2011. So like you could read that there. The 5-year review for the Say Whale published February 3rd, 2012. And then you have 5-year reviews for the endangered fin whale, endangered gray whale, Western North Pacific distinct population segment, and endangered Say Whale. That was effective March 30th, 2023, so pretty recent. And then published in August 30th, 2021 was the Say Whale 5-year review. So there was like some documents on that tab. And then if you go to the resources tab here, there's more documents and data and maps and stuff like that. So like the resources are there if you want to like read up on that a little bit more, which I think is really awesome.
Yeah, I'm going down the rabbit hole for the they have this acoustic passive acoustic study where they're putting like acoustic receivers designed to capture like cetacean noises in the water in certain areas. And so they have all of these little platforms. Looks like mostly off the coast of the United States, because NOAA is an American organization. But anyway, but it shows you like how many detections they've gotten, and I'm sure you could break it down by species. So right now I'm on North Atlantic right whale, but they have blue whale, humpback whale, fin whale, sei whale, sperm whale, porpoise. So that's it's a really cool visual representation of like the kind of work that's going on right now, and that's a good way to detect animals without like any kind of like physical interaction with them, which really is what we want to limit as much as possible.
Yeah.
So
I'm on
that's
that
a
map
cool
right
map.
now. It is. I'm on it right now for Say Whales. And there's I'm trying to zoom in on this because there's some green dots down in the Florida Keys.
They're possibly possibly.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Yeah.
that's a really cool one to look at if
Yeah.
you're interested in the kind of work that's going on.
I
Yeah,
don't
you
think I've ever
should.
seen a whale in the wild, honestly.
You should
I think
do
I
it.
would shit my pants if I saw one. If I was like a kayaker and I saw one, I'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah. We used to see them in Virginia on the trawl survey. They would come to the Chesapeake Bay, just the juvenile humpback whales. So they were babies. Well, teenagers, but I mean, they were still bigger than our boat. Like,
Yeah.
So it's crazy.
Insane.
So I've seen some actually breach, which was pretty neat.
All right, happy things.
Yeah, let's do happy things. Because I'm tired of talking.
Me too. Me too.
So do you have one? Because I kind of am having a struggle thinking of one today.
Happy thing is I go on vacation this week, so I'm super
Yay.
happy about that. A little bit of a break, but with the way work is, I'm only anticipating it's not going to be much of a break. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's at least getting out of town and seeing family, and we're going to spend half of our time in Virginia and then the other half of our time in the Outer Banks. And
Ooh.
I love the Outer Banks. So I'm super excited about
Yes.
that. While we're home, I'm going to show Alex two spots that I was thinking about, like wedding venue-ish area.
Get
But this
it.
week we'll see two spots and we'll see
Yeah.
which one he likes. I mean, I would even be down to do it in Iowa because he was born and raised along the Mississippi River and there's like really beautiful country up there. But like again, my family is not big travelers, so that's kind of like the sticking point. And
Yeah. Well, I hope all of that works out, and I'm excited for your wedding. Happy, we were on the happy things. God, I still can't really think of one. I guess silver lining, like the whole house wasn't ruined, and it wasn't like a bathroom flood. It was an AC flood, which means we don't have to
yeah.
shut off our water to get it fixed. So.
That's good.
And it's a rental house, so like we don't have to pay to get it fixed. We just have to deal with it getting fixed. I
Yeah.
mean, so that's, I guess it's a silver lining kind of
It could have been worse.
situation.
Could have been
Could have
worse
been
for sure.
worse. It could have been worse. All right. Well, where can our listeners find us?
Yeah, our listeners can find us on the I think I feel like I say that every time that yeah, our listeners can like that's how I open it up. Our listeners can find us on Instagram at Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast. You guys can find us on TikTok at MNWKY Podcast. We have a Facebook now. It's called Mother Nature Will Kill You. We are on Spotify, Apple, Google, all of those streaming platforms as Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast. And we also have a website, mothernaturewillkillyoupodcast.com.
And if you decided to race somebody to the South Pole and you want to tell us about it, or if you've been to Antarctica at all and you want to tell us about it, we have a story submission section on our podcast webpage, and then or you can send it to our Gmail. It doesn't have to be anything crazy, though. It can just be a time when you were uncomfy in nature, like maybe you climbed a mountain and it started snowing and you were a little concerned that you were going to get hypothermia.
Yeah.
Or maybe you were out in the desert a little too long. So, like, vice versa. We want to hear about it. We want to hear about how you dealt with it. In addition, if you want to support the podcast, but you don't have any money because we live in a post-capitalist hellscape. Is that what I say? No.
No.
What do I say? Why do I keep fucking
Because
this
we
up?
live in a
Just a capitalist
capitalist.
hellscape.
Yeah.
I don't
Yeah.
know why
I
I
don't know
was
where the post
thinking.
came from. I thought you were about to say
Because I think my brain was going
apolitica.
post-apocalyptic. And
Yeah.
then I was like,
I
wait,
couldn't
no,
even
that's
say
not.
apocalyptic. I was missing the C whenever I was trying to say it. I was like, apocalyptic?
I mean, apocalyptic is accurate too, but also capitalist hellscape. Please
Like.
give us a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts to tell the algorithm to make people listen to us.
Ooh. Go, go, go,
Yeah,
go, go.
so with that,
Stay safe, but most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
bye. The Kentucky Derby is on right now. Did you know that?
No.
So when you're talking about races, I was like, speaking of race.
Get your hats out. Let's go to the Derby. Good night.